All right, so welcome to the audio version of Obesity Panacea. Today, Peter and I are going to just have a little chat about one of his new publications and just see where it goes from there. So we're trying this out, and hopefully it goes well. So, hey, Peter.
Hey, Travis, how are you? This is actually kind of exciting that we're actually both going to be on the same podcast.
I know, we've been talking about this for literally months, if not years, so it's finally figured out how to use Skype. So.
That's a big step forward for us. Hey, although our first one was, I mean, that was both of us, right? Like, that took like 7 hours to complete, but...
Yeah, you put a lot of work into that. Yeah, and we were like sitting side by side, but since we don't live in the same town anymore, if you want to come visit in Ottawa, like every time I want to do one of these, that would work out well.
That'd work out really well, especially in South America, that it could work.
All right, so this paper, I brought it up here. So it's a letter to the editor titled, "Does Loss of Gluteofemoral Fat Through Diet and Exercise Deteriorate Metabolic Health?" So why don't you kind of get people up to speed on why you wrote this letter to the editor?
Right. Well, I've blogged about this probably now 3 or 4 times, so it's a bit of an overkill with us because we've covered this sort of loss of lower body fat so many times. But now because we're doing audio version, it's a whole new thing.
Yeah.
So
do one thing well, Peter. Do one thing well.
That's right. So I guess the first thing that came out was sort of the cross-sectional evidence that suggested that for a given amount of fat that you store in your belly, the more fat you store in the lower body, the healthier you tend to be, which is slightly paradoxical, but that was the finding. And so back in, I think, 2004... there's a bunch of researchers, I think from Japan, Okura and colleagues, who did a study. They extrapolated that finding. So if having more lower body fat for a given amount of abdominal fat was good for you, then they thought, okay, by extension, would that mean that if you lose that fat, that you would actually get worse? And they tested that using their methods, which had a few limitations, and their analysis actually came out to suggest that, yeah, actually losing lower body fat may actually... be detrimental to your metabolic status.
So it kind of fit with that cross-sectional stuff that having it is good, losing it is bad.
Exactly. Now, when you actually consider the physiology behind that, it doesn't really add up. So myself and then Dr. Jennifer Cook, now this is going back to now, I think, something like 2006, when we started sort of exploring these ideas, and we thought, you know what, it doesn't really make sense that losing lower body fat should be bad for you, because physiologically what's happening there is those fat cells are actually getting smaller and healthier in the lower body, which should really only make you healthier. Now, the problem with that original study by Okura and colleagues is that, like I said, their methods were a bit limited in that they used DEXA scan to sort of cut the body into parts and then look at relationships between loss of fat in one part of the body versus a metabolic improvement. But that methodology is a bit flawed because there's a lot of limitations to sort of what you can actually measure with DEXA, as you very well know, Travis. So I guess when you look at sort of the lower part of the body, there's a few tissues that you could sort of look at, right? So even when we consider fat in the lower body, it could be stored in at least 2 places that we know of, right? So you have the subcutaneous fat, which is sort of the under-the-skin fat, the stuff you can pinch, and then you also have intramuscular fat. That's sort of the fat that's sort of interspersed between the bellies of your muscles and your thigh.
That's like the marbling on your steak.
Exactly. Whenever I tell my parents about the intramuscular fat, you always use the marbling of steak. They really like that analogy. So while 90% of the fat in the lower body is subcutaneous, there's that 10% that's lower body, and the association between the subcutaneous fat and metabolic status versus the intramuscular fat and metabolic status is completely the reverse. So while evidence suggests the more lower body subcutaneous fat you have, the better off you are, the more intramuscular fat you have, the worse off you are. So it's a bit of a fairly complicated situation.
Right.
And when you use a method like DEXA, now you basically combine these two depots and pretend like they're one and the same, even though we know that metabolically they're vastly different.
And didn't their DEXA also combine abdominal and gluteal fat, or there was something else there too, wasn't there?
Exactly, yeah. So they wanted to see what was happening, so lower body fat loss versus trunk fat loss. But their trunk measurement actually included abdominal and gluteal fat, which those two depots are supposed to be sort of separate, right? So butt fat and thigh fat are much more together, similar, and different than abdominal fat. But in their analysis, they sort of combine those two. So that's just two of the limitations to that study. I mean, every study, as you know, has limitations. So just to pick on the limitations of the study, maybe not so fair. But it did sort of make interpreting those results a little bit problematic. So it wasn't, when we read that research, we thought, okay, we should maybe do this slightly differently and see if we can get at this question. So we did, and we've published that paper. We did this, we actually redid basically what their study was. So we looked at men and women who were overweight and obese and had some metabolic risk. And these people underwent weight loss intervention via diet and or exercise. And we measured their body composition using MRI, which is a much better methodology for assessing body composition, because you can actually assess, you can actually split up those various fat depots in the lower body, so you can separate the subcutaneous from the intermuscular.
And I'll just I just wanted to jump in and point out that if anyone's read our other paper on breast fat, they would be able to see exactly how that's done, because we have that nice little image in there showing how that's done. Do you have any other images like that in any of your other papers?
No, because most of the MRI methodology, sort of, as you know, our supervisor published on that like a decade
ago. Right, like 1990.
Exactly. So we got a little redundant including those MRI slides. So even though I've wanted to on a number of occasions, he was like, well, you know, we've included those in the past five studies, so we might not want to do it here again. But yeah, I mean, if you Google like visceral fat, for example, an MRI visceral fat, you probably get 1,000 images more or less the same cross-sectional slice that you and I have looked at on
for hours.
Okay, so when we redid the study, basically using MRI as the methodology of choice rather than DEXA, so we were able to sort of partition those various fat depots in the lower body, as well as distinguishing visceral from subcutaneous fat, which is also sort of a critical thing to do. We found actually the opposite. Now, mind you, our findings weren't all that strong, because we basically found a positive association for, I believe it was insulin area under the curve. So basically during a 2-hour glucose tolerance test, so someone's giving a bolus of sugar, and then you basically just watch what happens to their blood sugar levels and their insulin levels. So we saw that people who actually lost more lower body fat for a given amount of loss in other areas of the body, they had a greater improvement in their insulin response during that sugar test, suggesting that losing that lower body fat, subcutaneous fat particularly, may be basically as good as losing fat elsewhere in the body.
So all else being equal, you lose butt fat or leg fat, and you're not putting yourself at more risk. If anything, you might be improving yourself a little bit, but at worst, you're kind of coming out equal, right?
Exactly. That was almost verbatim our sort of the last sentence of our conclusion in that study, because you're right. There was a lot of outcomes for which the loss of visceral fat was particularly very strongly associated with improvement, and sort of butt fat loss. Butt fat machine. That's great. loss wasn't significantly associated there, but in no model, basically no statistical model, could I find any evidence for you know, losing lower body fat being a bad thing for you. So there's absolutely no need to worry when you lose weight, and of course you're going to lose weight from all parts of your body. Losing lower body fat is not a bad thing. So I guess that brings us to the letter to the editor, right?
Right. So then you were just basically responding to a review that kind of focused on the Okura paper and didn't really mention the newer findings that you and Jenna put out. Is that basically what you're doing?
Right. So this review came out, I think it was like in January or something, and it surprisingly, a review made a bit of a splash, which is a little bit, as you know, is a bit...
Yeah, not often. It's never happened to our reviews, at least.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't even happen for original studies, and then these guys came out with a review and made quite a splash. But I mean, that's good. When stuff like that gets out there, I'm sort of happy when it's interpreted properly.
Right.
In this case, the media sort of blew out of proportion. So these guys, I think it was, I'm going to butcher this person's name, Manolopoulos. He's Greek, so I should be able to do this well, but I'm destroying that name. Anyways. So him and I think who are the co-authors in that?
Cart and Frayne.
Frayne, right? Okay, so yeah, Keith Frayne. I think he's done quite a bit of good work. Anyway, so in that review, I mean, they look at the literature. They do a really good job reviewing sort of what's been said about lower body fat and you know what that might mean, and sort of look at sort of the underlying physiological mechanisms by which lower body fat might be protected and so on and so forth. And then they sort of briefly look over the idea of losing lower body fat and what that might do to health, and they sort of combine in their, when they're looking at this, they sort of amalgamate things like Cushing syndrome, which is cortisol excess. When these people sort of have this redistribution of body fat, they actually have, they do lose lower body fat, but that loss of lower body fat seems to actually be happening by death of fat cells. So you're actually losing tissue, which is not good.
Right.
You're losing that tissue that is able to suck up excess energy. So the less of that tissue you have, the worse off you are. So, and the same thing happens in lipodystrophy. So lipodystrophy, as you very well know, individuals start losing their subcutaneous, or that under the skin fat, sort of throughout the body, but predominantly sort of peripherally. So lower body fat is very often one of the first things to go. And these people end up sort of gaining visceral fat, so that intra-abdominal fat, they seem to increase. And they sort of take on this sort of like pseudo-athletic appearance, like you can almost see the vasculature in their legs and their arms, and yet they're getting less healthy because they're losing sort of subcutaneous fat. They're losing that ability to store excess energy in places where it doesn't seem to lead to a whole lot of problems. So you have these two disease states in which, yes, lower body fat loss, particularly subcutaneous fat, seems to be a bad thing with regards to metabolic risk. And they sort of draw a parallel between that and what Okura and colleagues found in their earlier study. And for some reason or another, the paper that Dr. Cook and I did, along with Dr. Ross, of course, was overlooked. And I mean, and I completely understand that. You and I have done reviews. You know how hard it is to find every single study under the sun on a given topic.
But, oh, yeah.
You know, the amount of literature out there is just, it's almost impossible to keep track of. So it's very easily that something could be missed, especially when there's, like, right now there's two papers on the topic, right? So, I mean, I can see how it can happen. So in the letter to the editor, sort of in a response to some of the stuff I was seeing in the media. So, I mean, even Saturday Night Live, I was watching it, and they even have in their sort of weekend update, they had a skit on, you know, big booties and how that's good for health and stuff. And, you know, don't lose your booty because you're going to get less healthy or something. And I thought, okay, this is not the right message to be sending to the public, right? We have a predominantly overweight and obese public who already, despite sort of all that they know about the dangers of obesity and the benefits of weight loss, are not all that willing to try to lose their weight. So, and I'm thinking, okay, now we're just giving people an excuse to not do anything.
When it was even, I remember on a few of the blogs that we read, even, you know, physicians, people that are knowledgeable about this area that were kind of saying, well, maybe we should be more careful when people have, you know, the gynoid body shape. Maybe they shouldn't be losing body weight. And it was kind of, for whatever reason, this meme really kind of caught on. And it was kind of surprising because, well, we've talked about this all the time, that really the mechanisms don't add up. There would be no way that losing lower body fat through diet or exercise would increase your health risk, or none that anybody's ever suggested anyway. So it was kind of weird how quickly that idea caught on, that losing lower body fat could up your health risk.
Exactly. Yeah, so I remember actually when this thing happened on SNL, I was sitting there and I saw the review come out, and I read, and I thought, okay, well, they sort of missed that point, but I mean, the rest of it is pretty good. There's quite a bit of, like, the physiology behind it was quite detailed and stuff. So I thought, okay, well, you know, some more attention to that area of research, which sort of from a selfish standpoint, it's like, well, that's kind of good. That's the kind of work that we do, so that's pretty good. And then I saw it on SNL, and I was watching it with my partner Marina, and I was like, okay, I need to do something. You know, you just knowing that sort of I'm the only one that had this study out that suggested the opposite, and now it's in the media, and everyone thinks completely contrary to what we've shown.
It's like the sum of all fears for a researcher. People finally care about your area, and they're taking exactly the wrong message from it.
Exactly. So that night, I basically decided that we needed to write a letter to the editor to that journal to suggest that, you know, there might be an alternative explanation that these authors didn't consider. So Dr. Cook and I decided to write this letter, and we did, and it was, I mean, it's fairly straightforward. I think it's it turns out to be a page long when it's published. And in that, we simply said, like, you know, we enjoyed the review, it was well written, blah, 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 there's a lot of good information there. The one thing we sort of take issue with is this point on, you know, drawing a parallel between disease states and loss of lower body fat and what that might do to metabolic risk, and the loss of lower body fat that occurs during weight loss via physical activity and diet, and what that might do to metabolic risk. And we said, you know, physiologically, you would expect that loss of lower body fat, much like loss of fat from other parts of the body, should be beneficial because you're only improving the function of that tissue, right? So you're just making it better able to suck up that excess energy that you might be consuming. And of course, we drew the author's attention to our original study that suggested that if anything, it might actually be beneficial to lose lower body fat. And for me, this was the first. This is the first letter to the editor that I wrote, and additionally, it was the first publication that I had that wasn't with my supervisor, right, Dr. Ross. So
yeah,
it was exciting and yet a little anxiety provoking because I sort of feared that I was putting myself out there a little bit. You know, letters to the editor tend to be a little bit more opinionated, right? So I was fearing a bit of a backlash, and the editor from the International Journal of Obesity, in which this paper is published. So again, I guess we should probably mention this paper is now published ahead of print on the International Journal of Obesity website.
Yes, and I'll put a link in the show notes or whatever they call them, so that however people download this, they'll be able to visit the actual paper.
Right. Perfect. So. When the editor responded saying that they accepted the letter that Dr. Cook and I wrote, he added a line right at the end saying, "Oh, thanks for the letter. This actually turned out to be a really good exchange," or something. Of course, suggesting that the original authors of that review responded back to our letter. But we didn't see that letter until the very day that I saw my letter and they published.
Oh, so I haven't actually read their response. What did they say?
It was very, very positive. They said, more or less they restated basically what I said in fewer words. So, yes, okay. we understand. Thank you. And that's sort of – I was fearing that, you know, maybe I missed the boat on this somewhere. Maybe there's another study that I didn't know about and they were going to call me out on it. So I was pretty happy to see that they saw, okay, well, yeah, we missed something. Someone else pointed this out to us, and now the picture is sort of complete. Of course, the unfortunate consequence is that the media is not really latching onto this letter to the editor as much as they did to the original finding. But in sort of that altruistic sense of being able to move science forward, I sort of feel, partly vindicated, and yet I feel like it's sort of – It's benefiting whoever's going to read this, because once that article actually goes into print, I think the article along with the letter goes along in the same issue of the journal.
Right.
So basically, as soon as someone's reading the print version of that article, directly following it will be my letter suggesting that there's maybe some, you know, notions that are not completely correct in it.
So if anyone still reads the print version of journals, they will see your letter. Is what you're saying.
Otherwise, it's up to you and me to sort of
force
it upon people via podcasts and blog posts and whatever means available. Yes.
Well, this kind of brings us to kind of the other thing that I mentioned that I might ask you about, that people brought up sort of the public health nature of blogging during your defense, and this to me seems like kind of exactly the point of having a blog or a podcast or whatever, that, you know, the media is missing the boat. And the blog or whatever social media you want to use is kind of the only device that we have at this stage in our career to try and set the record straight, other than letters to the editor. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like this is sort of the only public health way we can influence the discussion. Like, what do you think about that sort of thing? I'm not sure if I worded that very well, but I think you know where I'm going with it.
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean. Even if this letter to the editor had not been published, right, which is almost—that's a very likely outcome of any submission to a journal, right? Like, very often you get rejected, and you can't really go elsewhere with a letter to the editor because that's the journal in which the original review was published. But even at the same time that I had sent this letter, I had already sort of I had already discussed this issue on our blog, right? So that I was able to use some of the fodder from my original thoughts on the blog to actually write the letter to the editor, which is something I never imagined myself doing, right?
Right.
You know, basing your actual research paper on something that you blogged about before.
Well, I think actually just kind of building on that, because I remember telling you about this, is Science Online, and I think I actually saw the review paper on Dr. Sharma's blog and then sent you, like, the link through that. So I'm not sure if that was – I mean, you probably would have come across it eventually, but it was interesting that the first time that I saw the review, at least, was also through a blog.
Right.
Okay. You know what I mean?
So there's a lot of blog connections to this whole story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, if you and I were at the level of an academic at which you're invited to all these international meetings and you get to fly around and give talks to a lot of people, then yeah, maybe what we're doing is maybe not as necessary because you have another venue by which to do that. At our stage of the game, I think if there's other sort of up-and-coming PhDs and doctoral students and even master's students that are doing research and they're excited about it, but, you know, they're not really getting the limelight because they're fairly early on in their career stage, I think it's an excellent way to, one, engage the public, right? I mean, already every paper that we've published, we tend to discuss it on our blog. And as far as feedback is concerned, I've had so much more feedback via the blog than I've had via peer-reviewed research, right? I mean, that's sort of what drew us into blogging. It was one of the main reasons we wanted to do it. You look at the number of people that are citing our work, and, you know, there's a few here and there, and as the years go by, more people cite it. But it's a lot more sort of personally, it's a lot more rewarding when you have a conversation with someone you never would have, a conversation with before about a finding in your study that they are actually... they're able to use that information to sort of improve their life or whatever. That's right. A lot more powerful to me than, some other academic in some other country read it and cited it somewhere. So, personally, it's a lot more satisfying to have that conversation with real people rather than just more academics.
Well, and hopefully it'll work out both ways, right? Like I remember Dr. Ross always saying, you know, that it's when you're, you know, out discussing your work with other people and showing it at conferences, that's when it really gets cited and really gets, you know, put to work and put to use in the scientific community. So, I mean, hopefully, not only is, you know, we assume someone's reading this stuff. Hopefully, it's not just, you know, but like you know, lay people, but also researchers, and kind of, you know, hitting both populations at once, I guess.
Right, and that of course is would be ideal. And I mean, the academic part of things, we tend to think we're doing our best to sort of expose ourselves in that circle, one, via peer-reviewed publications, two, via going, you know, presenting at these international conferences that we commonly go to. But I always felt like it was the layperson that was missing out on all that information, right?
Right.
You know?
So, no, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, so I definitely see the benefit of blogging, and as I've, I think I listed in my acknowledgement letter to my PhD thesis, it's probably one of the more rewarding parts of the entire graduate experience for me personally.
So let's wrap things up there. So that'll conclude this inaugural podcast in this format. Thanks for listening, everyone. And don't forget to visit us on scienceblogs.com/obesitypanacea. You can leave comments on this post or on any other. And we look forward to our next podcast. And thanks for listening. Bye for now.